This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Edgar Kuntz is here. He's had a big, huge book tour. He's from Baltimore, and he's going to read an opening poem.
Day Moon. After I left, I waited for someone, a friend or her herself, to walk quickly up to me on the bus or in the bustling coffee shop and slap my face, spit on my hands, call me a bastard, a real son of a bitch. By waited, I mean I wanted to be revealed by some visible sign, a welt to ride the ledge of my cheek through the glass-littered streets. It didn't come, and I grew desperate. I stared too long at strangers at Safeway. I bought boxes of clementines and ate them like a possum on the train, cramming the rinds in the gap between the seat and the wall. I drank warm beer. I made no calls. I sat on a hot metal bench by a briny lake and tried to imagine the lives of the joggers passing in front of me, their joys, their sicknesses and regrets. I was useless. I thought of my friend who wrote a novel over a long winter in Nova Scotia, read it once, and buried it in the copse of birches behind the house. He chose the spot, he said, for its plainness, so he couldn't remember later and dig it up. And in this way, one medicated season slid into the next without incident. Gardenia bloom, persistent sun. I fell in love with the perfect voice of a Midwest radio DJ from a station I streamed on my phone, called in one request after another. I fell in love with a video of Stevie Nicks singing backstage to her makeup artist. Sheer cotton dress, their harmonies breezy and immaculate. I woke around noon to the thup-thup of helicopters and another unsober voicemail from my dad angling for a loan. Went out in my underwear and found a fine black powder settling on the windowsills, dusting the parked cars, a day moon suspended in orange haze. It turned out a man who would go months without getting caught was methodically setting fire to the half-built condo complexes one by one. One in 10,000 residents is a billionaire, the same article told me, though I could be forgiven for thinking the headlands were burning again. The intervals between disasters collapsing, I caught my neighbor's eye. She was stretching on her stoop in a fantastic powder blue tracksuit. What a world, I said, and she didn't seem to hear, and jogged across the narrow street, the moon behind her rising or sinking or neither. It was hard to know.
That is Edgar Kuntz, if you can believe your ears. And just, there's even more of that to come. Edgar, what is the title of that poem?
This poem is called Day Moon.
Edgar, did you write it all at once?
I did. I wrote it in a big rush. And then, of course, over time, you revise things out or you think, oh, it'd be cool to sneak Stevie Nicks into this poem. Let me find a place for Stevie.
But it's in couplets.
Yeah, it's in couplets. Yeah,
that's so interesting because that's such a formalized way of making all that energy, all that tumult. Yeah. Fixed on the page. And what is the title of this book? The New York Times has made it their book choice. Yeah. And we're going to talk about that. Yeah. What's the title?
It's called Fixer.
Does the title tell what's happening in the book?
I think it does. Yeah. You know, I'm terrible with titles, if I'm being honest with you. And so I struggle to name my poems. Usually I just pull a little phrase from inside the poem and put it up at the top. Or, you know, I try not to get too clever with it. But for the book, I was really stymied. And I was showing it to friends and saying, you know, what do you think of this title? What do you think of this title? And I didn't really have anything that fit. And then I showed a draft to my sweetheart. And she came back to me and said, the title is Fixer. I don't know why you're messing around.
No wonder you stayed with her.
Yeah, exactly.
Good deal.
Well, it's perfect, right?
Well, what does it fix?
Yeah, right. Well, fixing is at the center of this book in a way. I mean, my first book was about growing up in a pretty chaotic household in a working poor family in New England. And the book, it's called Tap Out, is my first book. It came out in 2019.
And that, too, was noticed by the New York Times.
It was. Yeah, it was. And it's largely about, well, it's about, you know, childhood friends and growing up and moving away and trying to figure out what home means to me now and so on.
And odd jobs,
sure. But also about my first book is mostly about my father, who was an alcoholic and an addict and who died a handful of years ago at 52. He's only 52 years old. And so this book, Fixer, is in a way a continuation of that book, right? But it's trying to, my dad was a handyman, you know, so literally a fixer of things. And this book is so much about the tumult, to borrow your word, the tumult of my 20s, which were all, like sort of equally chaotic to my childhood, just making wild decisions, moving around a lot of places, falling
you
in and out of
love. You say you were a drifter.
So yeah, kind of a drifter. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And a lot of these poems take place in California, and that's where I was when I found out my dad had died. And so I had to go back home and sort of sort
all
through
of
his
that,
things.
And the world yeah. loves you for it.
Yeah. Well,
all of that was worth it.
Yeah.
Let's hear two poems.
Yeah, oh, sure, sure. Speaking of odd jobs, I used to work for McCormick Spice Company in Hunt Valley, Maryland, not too far from where we're sitting right now. And I taste tested dips. And so this is my dips poem. It's called Tester. I catch a bus out to the county and check in at a beige terminal. And they ask me about the smells and textures of various dips. And I click appealing or not appealing, then elaborate in the text box below. Artichoke and French onion, spicy three bean queso. I got in on referral. I live with 7 other people. I measure rent and how many sessions I have to do with the dips. I start testing what I can get away with. Notes of bright espresso, mouthfeel of a sunripe plum. I write longer and longer. I don't think they read a word. It's weeks before you're entered into the system, more weeks to get your tiny check. Aline says, if you think it's a scam, why do you keep saying yes? In the fluorescent room, I receive one dip after another from blue-gloved hands, always the same plain tortilla chips to dip with, the same hands clearing away the tiny plastic cups. I tinker with my descriptions. If I need water, they bring me water. In slightly larger cups.
You know, Edgar, I want you to win the Mark Twain Award.
Yeah.
I mean it because that kind of humor is so painfully wonderful.
Thanks.
But the Mark Twain Award, they're not smart enough yet. They keep getting broadside people, you know, like Billy Crystal.
Sure.
But, you know, I hope you will win it. I'll put your name in.
Yeah, yeah, put me up for it.
Why
would
not?
You write a little letter.
And then we could add that to your resume.
Oh, sure.
And he is the author of 2 poetry collections, Fixer, Echo, and that was a New York Times Editor's Choice book, Tap Out, also Echo. He's been an NEA Arts Fellow, a McDowell Fellow, a Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford University. And he's had poems in all the best places, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, APR, Poetry, Oxford American. He lives in Baltimore and teaches at Goucher. So, let's have another poem before
sure,
we go into
sure.
your life.
Yeah, so this is another weird jobs poem. I was living in Nashville at the time.
Oh, my.
Yeah, yeah. And my landlord called me and said, hey, could you do a last second favor for a friend of mine who's a modeling agent? And I was like, okay, what do you need me to do? And she says, well, you'll see when you get there. And so this is the job that I had to do when I arrived. It's called model. In a button-up and jeans, I pretend to pump unleaded into a rented Civic. In a peacoat and slacks, I pretend to pump premium into a rented Benz. Inside, I stock the already stocked shelves, Sun Chips and Snickers, jumbo packs of bottled water, Powerade, Coke. I wear a double XL polo with the excess safety pinned behind me, Jason stitched in thick gold thread above my pocket. I smile. I laugh without sound. When this is over, I will be paid in gas station gift cards I'll use to fill up the car I borrowed to get here. Meanwhile, customers come and go. Quarter milk, quarter tank, pack of smokes. Now and then, we have to ask the actual Jason to please stay out of the shot.
Where were you born?
I was born in Framingham, Massachusetts. Yeah.
What happened next?
What happened next? Yeah, right. My dad was a single dad for the first handful of years of my life, you know, and he was a chimney sweep, which sounds like a made up job, but someone's got to sweep chimneys, you know.
Charles Dickens told us that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So my dad worked for a chimney sweeping company. He would drop me off during the day with my grandparents and then pick me up at night.
Were they good to you?
Yeah, they were good to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. My dad was good to me for the most part, you know, in those early days.
You had a brother.
Yeah, I've got 2 brothers.
And are you the oldest?
I'm the oldest by 10 years.
Yeah, so that makes you very responsible.
Well, I don't know, but I my dad married my mom when I was, I think, 5 years old, 6 years old. I was in the wedding. You know, I was the ring bearer at the wedding.
Is there a poem about that?
No, there isn't.
There should be. There will be.
Yeah, maybe I'll put that in the notes. But yeah, and then they had my brothers, and then things really took a turn when my dad's addictions got pretty bad, and he was out of work, and it ended up being kind of a tough childhood.
You know? And now you're a Goucher, so how, I mean, I'm almost on top of stuff in Baltimore, and I don't remember when you got there.
Yeah, I came in, 2018, I think.
Oh, right, okay, so before recently. COVID.
Yeah, just
pretty
before
recently.
COVID. Yeah, just
and
before.
Did you apply for that job, or did they reach out for you?
Yeah,
and was there an opening?
No, so I actually, to take you through the sort of progression, I was a terrible student in high school, you know? I didn't really care about school.
We skipped preschool. But how were you at preschool?
Yeah. I think I was okay. I was an early reader, you know?
Oh, I
was
bet.
Good at spelling.
I bet you were, too.
Yeah, but I was rambunctious. I had some behavioral problems.
Rambunctious
and so
speller.
Yeah,
the worst. Because I was a lower grades teacher. The rambunctious spellers were the worst.
I know it. Yeah, yeah. Smart enough to
cause trouble.
To cause
so
trouble.
Then you got to middle school.
Yeah, middle school was terrible for me. We moved partway through middle school, so I grew up in Framingham, and then we moved to Manchester, Connecticut. And that's a really hard transition to make in a really, you know, jumbled up time in your life anyway. So middle school was a wash in a way. I was getting terrible grades. I was in the principal's office all the time and so on. I was really, yeah,
don't
struggling.
You wish you could send him the New York Times?
Well, I think I had to go through a lot of that to work some things out for myself, and I needed to come to some realizations, which happened in high school, really. I noticed that my friends were starting to take AP classes, and they were starting to, you know, take school really seriously. They had an eye on college. And I had a dim idea of like, yeah, maybe I'd go take some classes at community college or something. But my friends kind of convinced me like, no, you should take these higher level classes, and you should see if you can do well. Because like, if you want to leave this town, this is how you're going to do it, you know? And so I did okay for the last 2 years of high school, but not good enough, I thought, to get into good colleges. And so I went to community college. I did a year
and
at community college. And
you were very influenced by a teacher there.
Massively influenced. Yeah. This guy, Steve Strait, Professor Steve Strait, he actually just retired. I took this poetry class kind of on a whim, and he introduced me to this day, some of my favorite poets, some of my favorite poems. He was just a really passionate, and smart and encouraging educator, just everything I needed at the time. You know, he was like, you have something, you know, you could do something with this writing thing if you wanted to push yourself. And
how wonderful.
And it was amazing.
That one teacher.
Yeah.
Do you think that one teacher was your Volta?
Yeah.
Do you think that one teacher?
Yeah. Yeah, where my life turned. I know. Yeah, I think so.
If you didn't have him, nobody would have noticed you, maybe.
I know.
No, you would have risen like cream, I think.
Maybe,
to
maybe.
The top.
But it changed my sense of myself.
Of
you
course.
Know? Yeah,
so
what
then
I was capable
after
of.
Community college.
Yeah, I transferred to Goucher, which is now where I teach.
You were an undergraduate?
So I've come all the way. I finished out my undergrad at Goucher, and then I went to grad school, and then I went to Stanford after that, and then I came all the way back to Goucher, which is a long way of answering your question about how I ended up here. I just wrote to my old professor and said, hey, do you have any classes I could pick up? I had no prospects. I had nothing going on, you know. I was in California where the cost of living is crazy.
Where was your old professor? Who is he?
Oh, Steve is in, he's in Connecticut.
Okay, so...
Oh, but do you mean my professor at Goucher?
Should we name names?
Elizabeth Spires. She's
a
wonderful
poet.
Yeah, wonderful poet.
Well-known and much beloved.
Exactly, yeah. And so she said, sure, come back. You can teach a couple classes. And then she started to kind of taper down her own teaching, and I started teaching her classes. And then she just retired. And so now I'm sort of full-time. I've become my teacher, you know? Yeah.
You know, that is something.
Yeah, I know.
But do you feel you've always landed on your feet?
I do feel I've, yeah, for the most part, I have. Yeah.
Well, let's have a poem.
Okay, sure.
This is Fixer, and Edward Kuntz has broken through, I would say, the poetry world.
Well, anyway, maybe I'll read some poems, if it's okay with you, from the middle section.
Go ahead, give us two.
Okay, sure. I'll give you the first two. And as a preamble, I guess I'll just say that you know, my dad died. I got word that my dad had died, and so I went back to my hometown and met up with my brothers, and we were tasked with sort of figuring out what to do next. And so, you know, this first poem, well, this is a long poem called Fixer, and I say these middle pieces are all poems, but they're technically all part of the same thing. So I'll read the first two sections. We're breaking into your apartment through your bedroom window. The maintenance guy's ladder is propped against the sill. I climb the ladder rung by rung. It shivers. I try not to look down. A face appears in the glass. "What are you doing?" the face says. "I'm looking for my dad's," I say. "I thought this was his window." "Aren't you Ken's boy?" he says. "No," I say, "Chris's." "Oh, Chris," he says. "He's dead." "I know," I say. "I thought you could be Ken's," he says. "Sorry," I say. "Believe me," the face says. "Not my first rodeo." I climb down. We haul the ladder to the next window and try again. And this is the second one. Better than the minivan you slept a winter in. American Legion parking lot, siphoning gas for heat, but not much better. Cinder block apartment building on Homestead, a couple miles from Mom's. Got in through the window, waded through the cans and bedding, left it open for the smell. Tried not to look at the stain. Tried to be respectful, like in a museum. Stood for so long in front of your dresser, my brother touched my elbow. Everything we touch, you touched. Your socks, your coat, the cash in your pockets, the cellophane from a fresh pack, Zippo with a carving of a whale, proud ship in the distance.
Keep going.
Sure. Here, I'll skip ahead a little bit. It surprises me how little I recognize what's here. How long has it been for you, Noah says. Almost 10 years, I guess. Four for me, he says, stacking papers in a ShopRite bag. You think Mom wants any of this, I say. Would you, he says. I'll take whatever this is. I hold up what looks like a mortar made of bronze. A car starts on the second try. The window we crawled in through hangs crooked in its frame. I want the sword, he says. He points to the corner of the kitchen where a rapier leans in its scabbard, ornate and slim. Did you know Dad had a sword, I say. You don't remember, he says. No, I don't remember.
Wow. One more time.
Yeah. Let's do one more. You know, my brother said this poem to me out loud. I called him on the phone, and he just spoke it to me, and I wrote it down. It goes like this. Renee and I were doing some limb work, Noah says, on the tree out front, that twisty pine at the corner of the house, taking a couple widows off it. And Dad drives up drunker than I've ever seen him. Mm-hmm. We're close in a red Ford Focus. Gives me the biggest hug he can, considering he dropped 20 pounds since I last saw him. And I'm the ground guy holding the rope. Puts his arm around my shoulder and just kind of stands there, neither of us saying a word, not knowing after 2-3 minutes he'll get back in the car and drive off. Last time I'll ever see him. Because when you're the ground guy, you got to focus on the guy in the tree. You mess up and that limb swings out and hits the line. Bang, the whole block goes dark.
Yep. I remember that one.
Yeah.
But you know, when you go to your poem, it's always like you're reading it for the first time.
Yeah.
And it's like you go to the well.
Yeah.
Again.
I feel it.
You go to the well. It's like you could do a one. You wonder how these people, actors, do a one woman or one man show, and they can cry at a certain time, and it's not acting.
Yeah.
They go
there.
The well.
Yeah. One of my favorite poets, Jack Gilbert, on the back cover of his book Great Fires. I can't remember who said it. Maybe it was James Dickey or something. Said he goes inward further than is safe to go.
Well,
I love that.
Well, but you live it.
Can I read just one last? It's the last one in this section. Is that all right? Yeah. It's I published it separately. I published a bunch of these separately, but this one was called Piano. I held him together as long as I could, she says. He stopped working, stopped coming upstairs. He was like tissue paper coming apart in water, like smoke in my hands. It had nothing to do with you, baby. You left when you had to. I met a woman once who worked on pianos, said it was a hard job, the tools, the leverage, the required ear. I love it, she said, but it's brutal. The second I step away, it's already falling out of tune.
What did you do in Stanford?
At Stanford, I was so lucky. They gave me this fellowship called the Wallace Stegner Fellowship.
Yes.
And they pay you money, you know. They give you a stipend and you live in San Francisco or in Oakland. That's where I lived.
What did you apply in order to get this?
I think it was 10 pages of poems. You just send in poems and that's it. Maybe they had a short statement.
Was it from Tap Out?
Yeah. I hadn't even published this book yet. Yeah. So it was before I published Tap Out.
What an omen.
Yeah.
What did you do during your fellowship?
I finished writing Tap Out, and I wrote maybe the first handful of poems of Fixer. But the cool thing about that program was five poets come in at the same time. So you have a cohort of people, and you meet up once a week at Stanford to workshop poems together. And I got to study with, like, for example, Evan Boland, Louise Glick, you know, like huge, you know, really huge poets.
You're kidding.
Who I learned a lot from, you know. So, yeah, it was a really special experience for me.
Two of my favorite women in the whole world.
I know. Two of the greats.
Yes. So I think that you are going to be okay.
I hope so. Yeah.
Except you're building a house in Baltimore and you keep putting new doors on it?
Yeah.
That's what I hear.
That's word on the street, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. We bought a house. We bought my sweetheart and I. I got engaged this summer, so I guess my fiancé, you know?
Everything is happening.
I know. It's all happening. We bought a house and I'm a nutcase and I keep finding projects to do. The house is in pretty good shape, you know, but I think, well, I could change this or I could make this better.
Where are you getting the doors?
Oh, we get them. I have a poem about it. Do you want me to read it?
Yes, of course. Perfect segue.
Yeah, it's called Doors. There you go. It's called Doors. We get them from warehouses at the edge of the city, paging through upright stacks, slumping one heavily against the others and breaking out the tape measure to see, or if it could be made right with a table saw and a chisel. It's mostly my thing. Kay goes along, even spots the one for the bedroom, cut glass knob catching light as it swings. She knows the doors we have are fine. They open freely, they latch closed. She also knows I am a maniac who can't be stopped.
Mm.
She drags out a paneled turn-of-the-century oak with mismatched knobs, a half-length insert of beveled glass. We lean it against the others, her outline distorted by the waves.
Do you have things that close against the wind right now? I mean, is your house...
Is it airtight?
Yeah, yeah.
It is. Yeah, okay. It is. It is airtight. Yeah. These are interior doors, thank goodness. Although I did just have to replace the basement door after realizing that a
welcome
bunch of
to Baltimore.
I know. Some dampness got in the
do
brick.
Do you think you're
going
to stay here?
I love Baltimore.
Okay, thank you.
I really
because
love it.
I do too.
Yeah.
H.L. Mencken said it's a great medieval city now in ruins.
Yeah.
But I'll take it.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
It's beautiful. Listen, all my friends in New York, you know, they come down to visit us, or my friends from California, and they're like, wow, you have a beautiful a house and a garden and a great neighborhood. You own this house? That's crazy. And I tell them, like, listen, you can do this in Baltimore. Like a good life is possible.
And you're not in the flood zone?
No, I'm not in the flood zone. I'm up on a hill. Exactly. No, it's lovely. It's perfect.
Well, you teach how many courses?
I teach four a year.
Oh, just four a year?
Yeah.
How many a week then? One?
Two, yeah.
Two courses a week?
Two courses per semester, yeah. Yeah.
And what are they called?
So I teach all levels of poetry workshop. I teach intro, intermediate, and advanced.
Oh, so you don't teach the canon?
I do teach the canon, but as a part of the workshop. Yeah. So in each poetry course, in intermediate and advanced especially, we're reading 10 or 12 books of poems a semester. Yeah.
Good.
So it's like a combination writing and literature course.
Can you make up your own curriculum?
Yeah, I do whatever I want. Yeah.
Like, no kidding.
No, I have a lot of freedom. I have a lot of freedom, and I really value that.
Are you called the poet in residence?
No, I'm just an assistant professor. Yeah, I'm going up for tenure this year.
Do you want a letter on letterhead?
Would you?
I still have gold letterhead.
Amazing. I think that they'll be impressed by that.
I think it would just push you over the top.
It might. Yeah.
And let us ask you one more thing. Sure. What do you think of the students, you know?
I love the students.
But look what they're coming, living through. What could they be? What do they hope for? What do they want?
They've been through so much, you know?
But what are they like?
Yeah. Well, Goucher students are they're a special crew.
Well, it's a private school.
It's a private school, and it's in a way, it's like an, I don't know, I think of it as kind of an art school.
Yeah.
So my students are a bunch of weirdos, honestly.
Oh, good.
They have a strong sense of self-identity. They have a strong aesthetic, you know. They come in passionate, you know. They come in with a real, with drive, you know, but not in the way that you might expect. They don't have a drive. Well, most of them don't have a drive toward like getting straight A's. That's not really what's interesting to them. They're interested in finding out what their passion is and then myopically following that passion wherever it leads.
But they don't have a good basketball team.
No, terrible. Well, I don't know. Are they not good?
Some of the basketball players were not very good in composition. My friend taught them, but we'll strike that from the record.
Strike it from the record.
But, you know, I taught at Antioch in Baltimore before you were born in the early 70s during the Cultural Revolution. And so all of my students became social activists and did great things in the world.
Yeah.
But I don't know what these kids are going to be. Are they going to be capitalists?
No, God. Well, not a Goucher, no.
Oh, okay.
No, not a Goucher. No, there's a lot of activist spirit on campus, you know. Students are, I mean, I consider myself a deep progressive, you know.
Yeah.
And my students are surprising me.
No, you're deep.
It's great for me, you know, from a political standpoint, because my students are always sort of pushing me and saying like, well, what if you think about it a little bit, push that thinking a little further? Or like, have you read this or whatever? You know what I mean? Like they're on the cutting edge of progressivism. You know, not all of them, but I'm always shocked by how much I learn from my students every semester.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Oh, yeah. They're deeply engaged.
We are deeply engaged with you. Let us have a final poem.
Sure. This is it's a love poem. It's the second to last poem in the book. And in a way, it's kind of the reason why the book exists.
Do you want to say more about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
why does the...
I kind of think that for all the poems in this book and for all... I think it's a good book. I do. And I think some of the poems are the best poems I've ever written.
Mm.
But I think there's a kind of a touchstone poem in every book where you read it and you think, oh, that's the beating heart, right?
Mm.
And for me, this is the beating heart of this book. It's called Night Heron. It's all one sentence, so I'm gonna read it accordingly.
Oh.
Yeah, Night Heron. What now? You'd flown in from a Midwest city named for its rowdy summertime abundance, lying, saying you were coming to visit friends in San Francisco, and I'd taken the train from chilly Oakland to meet you, and we rode north, carefully not touching. I took you to the tiny one-room apartment I had escaped to after the divorce and fried us nervously some potatoes in a cast-iron pan, a little rosemary, which we did not eat because you kissed me hard, and we went in a rush to the mattress I bought off a guy in a semi-famous band and had only the day before gotten off the floor and onto the pinewood bed frame I'd found and hoisted on my back and carried down out of North Berkeley, arms wide, weaving through the side streets, towing the center line to avoid snagging the Buckeyes leaning out. It was about suffering in public. It was dramatic, sure, but the dramas of my life those days were pitched as high as I could stand, higher sometimes. I said, breathless, I want to taste you. And you said, please, yes. And later, out at the edge of the lake, huddled against the damp wind, hot grease soaking through a paper bag, licking salt from each other's fingers obscenely, a night heron peered up at us from the reeds, small, hunched, dipping its shining beak in the shallows, not particularly beautiful, but a heron nevertheless, the same one we were sure we saw perched on the awning outside the theater, whose marquee shouted slogans like, we live in a fake democracy, and prevent unwanted presidencies with hand-counted paper ballots, and later, the cabin we rented with friends in Calaveras, snowmelt vaulting the redwoods to magnificent heights, drinking rye, and each of us practicing our best wolf howl at the waning moon, which was ridiculous, yes, but once we started, it became impossible to stop, waking up next morning hoarse and happy, and you moved west, and we lived together in a studio overlooking the cafe dumpster, and then back east on a dream of a house and a garden, and then my father died, and at almost the same age yours did, and both from drink and an unnameable sadness. I went back to Connecticut alone 3.5 days, my mother said, before anyone had found him in his apartment on the far side of town, and going with my brother, which we should not have done, and dragging the mattress out, and clearing the maggots off the ceiling with a shop vac, and so on. And later you came, and we walked through the basement of my mother's house. I wanted to show you where for a while he lived and how. And you slung your arm around my waist, and we moved slowly together, bare fluorescent bulb shining on the Budweiser ashtray, the carpentry tools I would inherit, the ratty couch he crashed on for years. You held up an old Calypso record he loved and sang out softly, "Jump in the line, rock your body in time." And I sang back softly, "Okay, I believe you." And after a while, Mom at the top of the stairs shouting, "What are you kids doing down there?" And climbing the steps, you pinch my elbow and ask if I'm okay. And I hear myself say yes, which is not a lie, though I'm not listening. I'm letting myself feel how astonishing what our love can make of a place like that.
Oh, Edgar Kuntz. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, the Maryland Arts Council, the Song in the Room Group, Sandy Jackson Cohen, and the Rivada Foundation. Mike Turpin's our engineer. I'm Grace Cavalieri.